If you lean too far in one direction, something else in you leans equally far in the other. Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. I'm your host, Scott, joined as usual by Pat.
Hey, yeah.
Jason.
Hey.
And William.
Hey.
Today we're looking at 12 Rules for Life, or the second 12 Rules for Life, Beyond Order. And we're looking at the second two rules. Rule number 3 and 4, do not hide unwanted things in the fog. And notice that opportunity lurks where responsibility has been abdicated. So my first question to you, the viewers, and to all of you in the podcast, what is your conceptualization of the fog that he talks about in chapter 3? Let's start with you, Will.
I think the fog is that part of us where we're like clever enough to not deal with. And I think John Vervaeke has a good episode talking about this with the smoking and the probability charts that he draws out. Like the probability of having one cigarette and it won't kill you is like, it's very high. You're not going to die from your first cigarette, but the right. probability of all of the cigarettes leading to death is significantly high. And I think that we're playing that game on varying levels all of the time in our life with all of these different things. And I think it happens so fast that we don't even catch it most of the time. You know, like we're thinking like 150 thoughts in a millisecond, and it's like, oh, well, if you were walking in my shoes, you wouldn't think that, or you just try it for yourself, see where you get it. And all these little quick thoughts that you have and little micro fights that you imagine with people, and you don't actually act out any of these emotions that you're having about reality. And it's like, face it, because you're existing and it's existential. And if you're existentially suffering from things that you don't like, and you're playing this game of justifying why you deal with your burdens instead of just facing them, then stop it.
Yeah, just stop it. But you know, there's a whole chapter on it, so it's a little bit deeper than just stop it, right?
Face it.
Yeah, it's word hard it, to voice it. Yeah, it's hard to track all of those like habits that form over and over again as you just go through life. And you know, you have to defrag, so to speak, and notice that, because like the one example that he brings up, or one of the examples that he brings up, is like, if you're unhappy with, you know, the plates that you eat off at lunch every single day, that's going to add up after a while. So, you know, you just want to, it's worth getting the little things right, because they're every single day. And if you're dealing with something every single day and it doesn't feel right, then it's worth taking a second look at that. And sometimes you just never think to look at it. It's just, oh, it's that one part of life that I'm unhappy with but willing to overlook. One of these days it might not fall in that category anymore of able to overlook it. So you need to pay attention to those things.
Or even worse, you build these reservoirs and you accept it, but only to a point. And it's like you internally you've decided, you know, in 30 years, this is going to be the thing that I've had enough of and the reason that I'm going to leave. And it's like, that's a terrible plan. Like, you're literally planning to do nothing about it. And if it keeps up, you're going to eventually leave. Like, okay, that's not helpful.
Yeah.
Like, face it. And I was going to say something simple. Oh, okay, well, so fog. Hold on, quickly, the metaphor of fog in all these stories, because with this whole book, it seems like Jordan Peterson is using the story metaphor a lot, but I think one that he missed with the fog is that it puts a chill in your back, and it's damp, and it's wet, and it's awful, and you freeze up, and you don't know what's in the darkness and the fog. And it's like, if you haven't faced the things that you don't like in a long time, you're going to be in your limbic system, you're going to freeze up, you're going to bawl your eyes out, and you're going to say, this is a stupid thing. And I'm having a big reaction and I'm not even comfortable with myself right now. And it's like, that's okay. Face it, get through it, lessen it by experiencing it.
Well, I was just going to say that I mean, this is your life, so you might as well try to enjoy it. But you hit on the pay attention aspect, and I think that's something that Dr. Peterson is kind of, pay attention is an overarching aspect of what he's saying, because if you're not paying attention, it's impossible to stick to any kind of trajectory. And that's kind of what is at the heart of this chapter, that you are the hero of your own story. And so you have to make those decisions of what you want and don't want.
Right. And then there's the other option of like not asking the question. And there's another quote that he had in here that I really liked that said, "When ignorance and bliss, 'tis folly to be wise." So like the more you ask the questions and the more you have to deal with your own ignorance, the more you have to deal with that uncomfortable, foggy feeling, you know, the more you can't see visually, but it's blissful. So there's,
but I think like, especially when you look at, you know, society at large or religious institutions or norms that have just always been the way things have been done, like it's a question of standards and expectations and the social contract. And so by the time you reach adulthood, you've been programmed 15 ways to Sunday about what you're supposed to do and what is expected of you and what is the way things are. And I think it took me until a few years ago to say, you know what, the standards that I have discovered and the threshold of expectation that I'm allowed to put on friends is way too low for me. And the amount of fake friends that I'm supposed to have and feel that I have and associate with and pretend that they bring value to my life is unacceptable. And I deleted Facebook and I felt way lighter. And I established the fact that I have a small, close-knit group of friends that meet my expectations and that that's acceptable for me to have. And if you have to go 50 years not having any friends because they're all stupid, then fine. Don't do things you hate. Let me get ahead of ourselves.
Hey, yeah, spoiler alert.
One of the things that Dr. Peterson's talking about in this chapter, though, is repression, self-delusion, and he calls it willful blindness. So that you don't want to see the important things in life because you're essentially afraid of what you'll find out. And there's another, he's putting a lot of emphasis on what we actually do, our actions and how they are important. And in the last recording we did, we talked about the meaning of the word important is that which we carry through life. So you can't carry things that are not important because you'll just have clutter all around you. And he's tying this aspect of the things that we do that are important, especially those that repeat itself. So something you do every day or every week, it's almost as if it leaves some kind of imprint on our consciousness or on the fabric of reality itself, like a groove in reality. So if you keep doing those actions, they have some kind of karmic weight to them, and you find yourself in a rut after a while.
Yeah, I almost think of it as like it's carving little grooves into your brain. You just kind of have to smooth it over to fix
it. And I think, like, don't quote me here, I'm just a guy, but I'm pretty sure we have some science that proves that we actually do form strong neural pathways in our brain, in specific areas of our brain, as we repeat the monotonous lifestyles that we've accepted. And when we add in meditation or hypnosis or completely wildly creative and new adventures into our life, we form different pathways and we light up different parts of our brain, and we can expand the gray matter in our brain when we change it up and do something that actually activates us.
Yeah, maybe the fog is just every single part of your brain that you haven't yet explored. You know, like you're carving these little pathways and grooves through your brain, through your mental pathway there. And it's all foggy to begin with, but the more pathways you carve out with all of these new tools and psychotechnologies like meditation, the more the fog starts to lift and the more you can see the forest for what it is, not just a dark, scary, like dungeon.
And I think it's accountability, right? Like the fog is the lack of accountability. And when you start to speak and say, look, I have this thing that is concerning me in some emotional capacity, and you say this to someone who you care enough to say it to have in your life, to be able to have this rapport with, you remind yourself that, oh, right, love is more powerful than fear. And all I was afraid of was that this individual wasn't going to accept me and wasn't going to work with me to move forward and was going to take what I said or what I did and define me by that. And it's like, you're not your thoughts, you're not your actions, you're not your mistakes, you are, and then you do, and then you be, and then you have, but you don't need to be pigeonholed, and you don't need to feel that your loved ones are ever going to pigeonhole you. But that's exactly what's happening at a very rapid level. And it never comes to the surface as, oh, I'm scared that people won't love me. It comes to, oh, well, they're just stupid, or oh, they don't get it, or oh, they won't understand, or oh, I'm just not good enough. Oh, I'm unlovable. Oh, I'm not worthy. The world's gonna burn. What's the point? Oh, it's all gonna blow up in a million years. It's like, no, just love yourself and speak your truth, because the fog is your thoughts. And the minute you make action and energy and talk and write and communicate, that's when you leave the fog. That's my opinion. Change my mind.
So here's my understanding of what the fog is from reading this chapter. A quote that I've gotten was, "The fog is the refusal to notice and the refusal to communicate both yourself and the people who are close to you." And to put this into perspective, I'll use an example from a video game. So, I really like the Silent Hill franchise, which is a survival horror franchise. And one game in the series in particular is the second game that came out 20 years ago. The main character gets a letter from his dead wife who says, "Come and see me in Silent Hill." He notices he's got this letter about 3 or 4 years ago after her death. And when he walks into Silent Hill, it's completely foggy. It's haunted. Nobody's around. Everything is dead. And as he wanders throughout this town, he meets other characters who have their own problems. And you'll notice right away that the main character, James Sunderland, is pretty much focused on finding his wife, even though she's dead. And that's the one thing that is mentioned at the beginning. He doesn't even realize that she's dead, even though he's willing to go so far as to find her because of this letter he got. And he begins to see another version of his wife along the way and is trying to, flirt with him. It's kind of like a double-sided version of his wife. And he doesn't realize it. I mean, he does, but he doesn't see that this other woman that he sees for the first time is has some similarities between her and his dead wife. And the town overall is essentially the subconscious mind of the characters. And even though they don't realize it until, right before their deaths, they slowly put the pieces together. And so when James figures out finally that his wife is dead and is no longer around, he finally begins to accept himself for going through all this trouble, going through this haunted town, which may or may not be real. It may just be all in his head. And those closest to him, he begins to accept it. And that kind of refusal, that kind of problem that he ends up seeing is, it leads to an existential dread or an existential anxiety where you miss out on so many things that have gone past you when you're only just focusing on one thing and not seeing the whole picture. So I think that is something that we end up facing as a species, really. And it's probably one of the scariest things that we will ever face. That idea of letting everything pass you by when you're just in narrow vision of what you see down the road is probably the closest thing that you can ever do to yourself. And it's the most damaging too.
Hmm.
I mean, Pyramid Head's still scarier, but I get that. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Kind of lighten it up a little bit. But it's like that, what Jordan Peterson said in the second rule, you know, like a 20 something with potential and talent is like a good thing, but it gets more depressing in your 30s and even more so in your 40s. And, you know, the worst thing on this planet is squandered potential. And We're all creating this reality of priorities and values and focus and tuning ourselves into what we've determined to be the right truth and the real story and the important meat of the situation. So long as we're aware and observant and willing to face those things, and our reality rewards us enough and allows us to bear our suffering in a way that keeps us grateful.
Have any of you picked up the part where he talks about Sigmund Freud's defense mechanisms about repression?
He was also talking about like the difference between the sins of omission and the sins of commission.
Yeah.
Like you don't have to just do an awful act to miss the mark, so to speak, when he talks about sin. What were the more specific parts about Freud?
Well, he just mentions the, how many is it? 8 defense mechanisms. And they're similar to the 5 stages of grief, only there's 8. And they're more of an expansion pack, really. But the first one is denial, of course. So, for example, the truth is not so bad. So, and then the second one is reaction formation, which is, I really love my wife, I really love my family. And then the third one is displacement, where it's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy. So you adopt that copy and then put it off on somebody else. So like your boss yells at you, you decide to yell at your wife decides to yell at your child. Your baby tries to eat the cat, essentially.
Yeah, chain reaction doesn't end so well.
Yeah.
What was the next one?
Identification. The example he gives is, I am bullied, so I am motivated to be a bully.
Right.
5th is rationalization, a self-serving explanation for low-quality action. Intellectualization, a favorite of the early, funny, neurotic Woody Allen. He gives an example of Woody Allen and his career.
Yeah, he didn't flesh that out as much, but
yeah.
I guess it really just comes down to whether or not you're making action or if you're just pretending to be smart, right?
Yeah.
Coming up with a smart reason as to why the bad action wouldn't be effective when in reality, no action is the least effective.
that section on repression is kind of at the beginning of Rule 3, and then at the end of Rule 3, he kind of goes back into it a little bit more, where he's talking about admitting what your feelings are and being able to communicate your feelings to yourself and other people. He uses marriage as an example quite a bit, because I don't know if you can get a better team than, you know, a husband and a wife that are going to live together for 40 years, or, you know, it's equivalent to 15,000 days. You have to be a team in order to get through that day by day. But he also talks about how we all have been hurt, you know, through our childhood, growing up. We've been betrayed. And so talking about your feelings is kind of risky, and you have to have courage to trust somebody else, to say to them, you know, I'll trust you. I'll extend my hand to you despite the risk of betrayal, because it's possible through trust that you'll bring out the best in me and I'll bring out the best. And so I think that's what he's talking about. Cutting through the fog, cutting through to the delusion, is done by talking about and acknowledging the feeling. And I see I've bored Will.
It's an evening recording session, guys. I'm tired. It's almost my bedtime. I'm not bored, because that's exactly what we're talking about. That's about love.
So, like, in a marriage, you'll develop certain patterns. And we mentioned earlier, those patterns can become a groove or a rut, the actions we take. And one of the questions I kind of had while I was reading through this is, what patterns do you carry into the future? Are they foolishness, like you talked about in the previous rule, or are they ideal?
Yeah, one of the big things that I find myself saying a lot to people, and I might end up changing my tagline at the end of the videos, having watched far too much Star Wars in a short period of time, but I've been saying only the Sith deal in shoulds.
What? It's only the Sith deal in absolutes.
I know that.
Absolute.
I know that. And so that's why I've been saying that only the Sith deal in shoulds, because shoulds are very shoody, and I don't like it when people come at me with shoulds. And the minute you start coming at anybody with shoulds, it's like you've got an expectation that doesn't match up with the reality you're experiencing, and you're now holding me accountable for the way you feel about it based on what you predicted to happen that didn't happen. You suck at chess, but you don't get to have a hissy fit. Like, are you going to move rook to a4, or are you going to throw the chess pieces on the ground? Like,
right, but at the same time, he's saying that if you do not have ideals, that you end up with, like, purposelessness.
And, like, purposelessness is pretty much the same as meaning. So, like, you find your, you get meaning through finding your purpose and finding a goal. So it's all really, maybe they're not synonyms, but it's all interconnected.
Right, so if you have a lack of meaning, and it's some John Verbeke and Jordan Peterson talk about the meaning crisis. Pat, I think you were talking about the number of millennials who are experiencing depression. It was quite a large prevalence. But this may be why, because, you know, in the postmodern world, we say there should be no ideals. We shouldn't judge each other. And so it becomes difficult to find, you know, the right trajectory in life.
Yeah, then the proper aim becomes, well, everyone's paying attention to the victims in society, so that looks like where I should be headed. So, you know, you go into a bad route when you just want to go with the flow of everyone around you. You kind of have to step out of that.
I have been collecting my thoughts for a couple minutes now.
Okay.
Like, I don't think that you need ideals to have meaning. I think something's getting conflated here, and I think the words don't do their concepts justice. I think what you need in order to have meaning is a goal, and I think you need to attempt to reach that goal in line with your values and with boundaries. And I think that you need to know when you're trying to feed the crocodile in the hopes that it won't eat you until last, and when you're trying to make a beneficial partner and a move that would be interdependent and not codependent.
So are you saying that Jordan Peterson is making this error as a conflation, or that Jason and
I think we made it. Because chapter 6 is abandoned ideology, so I don't think...
Yeah, but at the same time, I've heard Jordan Peterson talk a lot about the ideal man and how, you know, religion is all about aiming towards that ideal man. Like, he talks about Jesus Christ himself being the goal of what any Christian would want to become. So I think he really does have a bigger idea of the ideal than your formulation.
I think that it's good to have a template.
Like, the ideal, the ideal may be better just as an adjacent thing beside your goal. Not as your goal, but beside it. So you have something to compare to, kind of thing.
Well, it's like, yeah, like, ideally I'd like to be doing this, but I'm not always going to have ideal circumstances. And that's where you have to abandon your ideology, because it's like,
right,
if you don't know what would be ideal, then you don't even know where to aim. But you need to accept that you're not going to perform ideally. You're going to know what it is. You're going to want to have something to shoot towards and something to shoot away from.
Yeah.
But you can't be like, oh, well, I'm not this, so I'm a failure, and now I'm going to do what failures do.
But that's when it introduces the idea of sin being, you know, everything that falls short of that ideal that you've presented for yourself, be it Jesus or, you know, whatever else that you have in your head as the ideal.
So in this quote where Dr. Peterson says life repeats and it's worth getting what repeats right, you're saying that his definition of right is goals and not ideals.
I think when he says life is what repeats and it's worth getting what repeats right.
Right.
What he means by that is not a question of ideals or goals, but simply of expressing desires, right? Like, and voicing your opinions and working through your own perception of reality, because you know when you don't like something. You know when things aren't ideal. You know when there's an easy solution to a problem, and for some reason you swallow it. And I don't think you need God or Bible or testament or commandment to tell you what size of plate to put your sandwich on. And I don't think we need to get too deep into the sophistication here of it's worth getting things right, because right is just a concept. And, you know, if we stay here too long, I'll tell you that there is no right or wrong. But
I think we've really hit some kind of a wall here on the difference between ideals and goals.
But let me see if this helps a bit either. Maybe it'll make things worse. I think that we don't have enough words for sin, right? Because if we think of sin as missing the mark, like a marksman shooting at a target and missing into a sin, because I think that's the metaphor that comes up in this chapter.
Yeah.
Then sinning should not condemn one to hell. Right? Because that's the wrong word. Missing the mark is not shooting the wrong thing. Because bad and sin now do not mean the same thing. And going to hell for having not become the best version of yourself does not read well.
Yeah, I don't really know how to react to that, because I don't know how a Christian would react to that. I mean, atheist Scotty over here saying, well, I don't believe in hell, so.
Well, it's like,
but I would argue that a Christian might say that, you know, everybody sins, so it's not just missing the mark that gets you sent to hell. It's, you know, I don't know. Embracing your sin or abandoning God or abandoning the ideal or not even trying. I think the aim itself and the missing of the mark are two different things. And I think that our language is too limited to be able to separate them at this point.
Well, that's what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, when most people say, well, sin actually is derived from an archery term, and it's about missing the bullseye. It's like, well, obviously you're not going to hit the bullseye every single time. We talk about this every week in our accountability meetings, right? But, like, you have to keep trying. And I think it's when you stop trying, when you stop aiming for the ideal that Jordan Peterson presents as Jesus and others present as just your ideal self or your higher self. I don't know. It all gets pretty messy.
So there is one thing in Rule 3 that gets restated in Rule 4. And that's on page 103, where he's saying, if you make what you want clear and commit to yourself to its pursuit, you may fail. But if you do not make what you want clear, then you will certainly fail. You right. cannot hit a target that you refuse to see. You cannot hit a target if you do not take aim. And equally dangerously, in both cases, you will not accrue the advantage of aiming, but missing. So there is something that you can learn in having a set target and not hitting it, because you can readjust yourself and see, you know, what did I do wrong? Or possibly it might not even be the correct target. You might realize that your real passion is a different target.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe we should, with that, move on to the next chapter where he's talking kind of about responsibility.
Yeah.
Notice, it's because that's where I felt the direction of the talk, the discussion was going.
Mm-hmm. Notice that opportunity lurks where responsibility has been abdicated. And the first thing that I thought of when I read the title of this chapter was, you know, responsibility that you yourself have abdicated in the past. You know, there's responsibility to be found there, but he starts off the chapter and kind of saying, like, in a work setting, if everyone else is slacking off, not picking up any responsibilities, that, like, that's available for you. That's a golden nugget. You can just pick that up, take the responsibility and do it yourself, and that helps you out in the long run. So that was a chapter that really changed by the end of it, in my head anyway.
It's one of those things where you go back to that list of those, that checklist he has with his clients, where it's like, are they in a career or a job that is satisfying and fulfilling? And I think he makes a lot of assumptions with the advice he gives in this chapter, which is that you're gainfully employed in an environment where you're both respected, appreciated, and rewarded, hopefully. And, you know, that hopefully as the addendum to the context and the frame that this advice is being put into doesn't really do much for someone who's working in a manufacturing environment where if you pick up the slack, you'll be the guy who picks up the slack and your wage is determined by corporate and there is no room for human reward because it's just by the book, here's the policy, and every year you get an extra 25 cents an hour. So, like, for myself, like I've said, I'm in a position where for the first time in my life, I'm physically capable to perform the job full time and mentally satisfied by the work I do. And it's taken me 15 years of employment and not being post-secondary educated to get to this spot. and it's not what I want to be doing. Like, it's great. It's a nice stopgap as I build my business. But I'm not in an environment where there's things that are missing to do. There is no responsibility to pick up. And it's like, how do you apply this advice beyond the home when you have a crappy job? And then you find yourself doing everything around the house. And then you get into an interesting place where it's like, now you're having different conversations with the team.
I think in a way it kind of shows you, it kind of shows you what you're capable of, even if you don't like it. And you putting yourself in that position goes to show what you can do that you never thought of before, I would say. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I do see what Will is saying, though. If you pick up the slack, your boss might assume you don't have enough work, and then you're going to get more work for the same paycheck. Though, at the same time, I've had minimum wage jobs at, like, Pizza Hut, for example, where the floor was dirty, the bathroom was dirty. I just decided, hey, I'm going to go do that. You know, I didn't have anything else to do. Boss saw that I did that, and he was pleased. And so he would give me better positions if I requested them. But I think we should also remember that Dr. Peterson is a professor. And so maybe part of his professorship kind of rubbed off in this chapter, where he's assuming that all jobs are similar to what he had.
Yeah, like, I'm more leaning on the side of Will there. Like, every job I've ever had, you know, you start to put a little bit more effort forward, and, you know, you're still the guy making minimum wage. They just ask you to sweep the floors every time there's someone needed to sweep the floors. But at the same time, I don't really think that is the center of what Dr. Peterson was trying to get at, because it's more of like a mindset thing, where if you're like, if you're just bitter about everyone else around you slacking off and not doing anything, you could just do the work and then be happy that the work got done. It doesn't really, like, taking credit for it or rising up the corporate ladder, it doesn't have to factor into it too much if it just gives you more meaning in your day-to-day duties. Because, like, you're still going to be stuck at work for 8 hours a day. No matter what, you might as well do something with that. You know, if you're going to do something, do it right, my parents always told me.
Like, and I hear all of that, right? And also,
I hear you, dude. I hear you. For those listening at home, he just started shaking his head.
I'm trying to say this in a way that's eloquent and poignant, where it's like, okay, so the advice is, notice that opportunity lurks where responsibility has been abdicated. But the advice is not, notice that you're complaining about the fact other people aren't doing work that you're noticing that needs to get done, and that maybe if you actually cared about the work, you would actually just get the work done and be happy that the work's done. But this isn't really what it's about. You're just upset that nobody's doing all the other work that you don't want to do, that you're not doing in the first place. So maybe if you ascended to a different, higher, like, wavelength of reality and thinking, and you started banging stuff off, you'd be really proud of yourself and people would recognize you, and you'd move up in the world. But that's not what's going to happen. You're going to do the sweeping, and you're going to be grudgy about it, or you're going to do the garbage on the Tuesday because no one else is doing it properly. And then you're going to be grudgy about it, and you're going to hold it over people's heads because you didn't even want to do the damn garbage, and you're not happy.
Well, hold on. He's very clear. Dr. Peterson is very clear that you have to do this voluntarily. So if you're doing the floor, if you're sweeping the floor begrudgingly, that's not the right way to do it, right? He says that he talks about dukkha. So in the Buddhist sense of the word, dukkha is suffering in life. It's where I think he literally translated it to, the pole of the axle wheel is not perfectly center, and so that wheel can't do its proper job. So the idea here is that you're going to suffer in life. You're going to experience dukkha. But if you take that on, that work on voluntarily, you can gain meaning through it. And it's almost like the alchemist transforming something worthless into gold. You can take on a suffering voluntarily and transform that into some kind of inner light and not lord over other people that you're doing it.
How?
You just put the weight up on your shoulder and start carrying.
Oh, okay, yeah. Then you feel zen about that? Sorry, I'm just a little devil's advocate.
You only feel zen when you start thinking about the work you're doing. I think the actual work, sweeping the floor or cleaning the bathroom that no one wants to clean is actually easy, but thinking about it is what's difficult.
Yeah, and it's kind of like how army recruits do it. They think that they're going to be with the generals, but instead their first task is to clean toilets. Even if they're higher rank, they still have to do that.
Yeah. And it's nice to be able to, like, so I'm at a place where I like doing things, right? Like, it's a win. It's a victory. And I get it. And I accept it. And I'm proud to do it or humbled to do it or whatever it is. Like, today, you know, as Canadians, we like to do this thing where we spend 6 months of the year shoveling the snow off of our driveways. And then for 5 days in March, we shovel all the snow that's left back onto the driveway so that it'll melt quickly. So today, you know, we had five of us out there each taking turns doing four scoops of shoveling. And it's rewarding, and many hands make light work. And it's wonderful to be able to engage in that. And I'm going to have to do some meditation on how I got over the notion of this. And it's the easiest thing to do for conflict resolution. You know, someone gives you a hard time over something you didn't do. You're like, oh, right. Yeah. Okay. I'll do that. Problem solved. Like, or for me, it's like we have shared towels in the house and, you know, my father likes this one towel. It's like, you know what? I'm just never going to use that towel again. You like that? Have it. It's better to give than it is to receive. I'm never having this conversation with you again.
I'm not going to touch your dirty towel ever again.
Well, so there was a motif that I picked up on, kind of the good brother against the bad brother. Dr. Peterson talks about Osiris and Set battling it out. And I thought back to the Bible, which Ross are reading, and the differences between Cain and Abel, and how Cain, or Set, the Egyptian god, you know, maybe they're going about life cursing what they have to do. You know, they get a tough job and they say, you know, as soon as trouble starts, you know, you start cursing, God damn it. And, compared to the good brother, where they're voluntarily saying, you know what, came across this trouble, I'm going to figure out a solution to it instead of starting to slur profanities.
Well, and it's an anxiety of sorts, right? I think the problem, you know, one of the big things that I'm overcoming is getting playfulness back in my life and doing things in the spirit of play, even excessively productive things in the spirit of play, because that's the whole point of life, is to go about it joyously and happily. And it's like, if you have dishes to do and you can't figure out how to be meditative or even happy or proud of cleaning them, then you're thinking about it wrong. And what probably happens is you've left the present moment where the dishes are dirty, and you've gotten anxious about the construct in your mind of what is entailed in doing the thing. And it's like, now you're not even in the moment. You're in some simulated hallucination in your mind about the responsibility that you don't want to take on, when you should just be breathing and cleaning, because
you're in the fog.
What better to do?
You're stuck in the fog. You can't navigate it if the dishes are gonna bog you down, right?
Yeah, these chapters kind of build on themselves. So
Mm-hmm.
it's all about adopting responsibility and trying to perfect your skill at it, practicing that skill. So if it's washing dishes, you could be the fool and cursing and breaking dishes and tossing one against the wall because it just can't get that spot out. Or you can do it like the master and wash one dish at a time, get it done, and then go on and not think about it anymore.
Put on some music in the background, help it go better. Put on some Meaning Wave.
Yeah, that's the thing too. Like, people go to do these things and they're like, oh, I hate doing this thing. And it's like, yeah, but are you doing anything that you enjoy while you're doing it? Like, what's your reward system? What's your punishment system?
Yeah.
You don't build that in. If you don't celebrate, like earlier, we were having our accountability meeting and I clapped until everybody clapped so that we could celebrate the win that Jason shared with us because it's important. And I was doing that with my 3-year-old nephew today, like audibly clapping and celebrating and high-fiving because you don't get it. This is the action that indicates to your brain that this is a big deal and that we care enough to celebrate it with you. Literally, it might feel stupid, but your brain does not differentiate between stupid or having not celebrated.
Yeah, your brain at the deepest level doesn't care how stupid or cringy it is, right? It's just, oh, we're jiving, we're having a good time, we're celebrating, let's do this. This is what happens when I accomplish my goals. Well, let's go.
And it's something that he talks about in chapter 3 that gets reiterated in chapter 4 in a way. If you are going about your responsibilities in a way like a fool, like the beginner,
Well, it's almost like, the fool goes at it knowing that there's stuff that he doesn't know and he's got a good sense of spirit to it. He's willing to take the risks. And then I think we need something other than the master to compare to. It's like the spoiled prince that's like above it, right? That's where you want to stay away from. You don't want to be the petty tyrant that's like, this is for my servants to do.
Yeah,
Like
well,
the
like
best
the
leaders do
I think
work.
the point is the like archetype of the fool and then the archetype of the master, the fully realized being. Like everything in between that is humanity. Like that's all of us. Every one of us falls somewhere in between those two, so I think it's useful to have like just carry the fool around with you everywhere, and you know that if you're about to aim at something that you're going to miss the first time because you're a fool, you're a beginner, you've never shot a bow before, you're not going to hit the bullseye, but you
But
can't be afraid to sin.
what's the archetype that's arrogant and toxically perfectionistic and expects to get it right the first time, fails once, and never performs again? Because that's what
It's
20-year-old men have. That's the
somewhere
fool.
between the seeker and the warrior. The warrior can be a bully sometimes and can take every ounce of strength to take on an obstacle. But it can also be toxic too, like before or after taking on that task and thinking, I'm number one at this. Nobody else can do it but me. And then the seeker is a bit of a perfectionist, which is a problem where the seeker can think creatively and come up with these different patterns and formulas to present a message by it. But it takes them a long time to do so. It'll take them ages.
So,
So.
like, Naruto's the fool, Sakura is the seeker, and Sasuke is the warrior. And if you're going to be anything to start out as, you want to be the fool, and you want to be giving it 100% of what you got with no regard for the expectations and standards and rules and the laws of physics, because you're just going to make it happen because you can do it and you're a fool. Whereas, the seeker is like, oh, I just need to do a bit more research.
Yeah. And also, in a way, the fool can sometimes not be trusted Like at the very beginning, nobody can trust you until you decide to put your own energy and effort into it. And then they'll think, okay, he's doing it this way. I can see what he's doing here. Maybe I can adopt something from the fool and then maybe try it out or just stick to my own routine.
And only the fool can become Hokage. So there you go.
But yeah, I think that's an archetype you see in a lot of shows as well, is the guy that refuses to be like small in spite of the fact that that very refusal is what defines him as small for anybody who's woke enough to see what's really going on. Toxic independence, you know?
Yep.
Because the fool is always willing to engage and learn and be amazed and awestruck by the achievements of other, whereas this Sasuke archetype that I'm meditating on right now, you know, is like, it's just, it's further evidence of his insurmountable failures. Every time he finds someone more powerful than himself, he's like, oh, well, I'm just not good enough.
Or in another example, I don't know if any of you have watched the war film Hacksaw Ridge, but the main character of that movie, and it's a biographical film, by the way. The main character wants to be a medic, and he is also very caring. And his crewmates don't take lightly to him. And he refuses to pick up a weapon and use it to shoot the enemy. He would rather save people. And you watch him struggle from boot camp and working his way up and dealing with these different policies in the army where, yes, you have to pick up a gun and shoot the enemy or else you're not going to get drafted. And yet he keeps to the core of his principles and saying he would rather save a life than have a life be taken away from him. And that's what his principle is. And eventually he joins the army and goes to war with the Japanese and ends up saving hundreds of soldiers and gets the highest reward, the highest Medal of Honor award in that. Wow.
There you go. Opportunity lurks where responsibility has been abdicated.
Yeah, no one else was doing the job that he saw was the one that should be focused on, so he took responsibility. He got it done. So it doesn't have to be that, like, someone is, you know, slacking off on a specific job. It could just be that you found an opportunity that no one else is taking advantage of and you feel could benefit other people or yourself even.
There was one thing that I wanted to mention about Rule 4 and responsibility, because Dr. Peterson uses the example of marriage quite a bit. And it seems like people, they have the goal of getting married, right? And so they get engaged and then they get married. And then they stop the pursuit of that goal because they're no longer, you know, they've transcended it in a way. They no longer need to get married because they are married. And so they no longer try anymore. And so they abdicate their responsibilities to the marriage. And then what happens, you know, you stop making yourself wanted. You stop trying to impress and show your best self to your partner. And then so maybe your partner loses interest in you and somebody else then picks up on that opportunity and they're like, yeah, let me show you my feathers and let me flex. And that draws their attention because it's kind of a game of cat and mouse that you have to play in a way. Not that marriage is a game, but in a way it reminds me of Akira the Dawn's song, "Everything is a Scam," but replace that with "Everything is a Game." It's not I'm not trying to make light of marriage, but at the same time, right. I kind of see the idea gamification of life. So you still have to keep trying even after you've mastered something.
Yeah, it's like when Jordan Peterson says that, like, life isn't a game, it's a series of games, and marriage is just one of those games in the greater game of life. It's just through that frame you have to look at everything as a game, so it makes sense to use that terminology. But I think this is one of the things that, for me, Jordan Peterson, like, he starts with, and then John Vervaeke just, like, finished it. Because, like, John Vervaeke talks about this same problem. He talks about the difference between the having mode and the being mode. So, like, most people aim to have sex instead of being in love, or, you know, getting married instead of having a successful marriage or relationship. Like, it's fundamentally two different things. And when you aim at just, you know, oh, I'm just gonna be a married person, that'll be my identity, and then you don't take it any further than that, it's what are you doing with your life? You still gotta try. Like, you're still involved in something that requires upkeep and effort.
Yeah, it's almost like you can fall into the trap of, well, I've been accepted for who I am, so I don't need to work at it. And it's like, yeah. That's the fog, right? And it's like, exactly. There's all these things that we do, you know, when we're trying to get a date or a job, and these rules that we take for granted the moment we get into that safety zone of like, oh, well, why would I get dressed up? We're married. It's like, no. Much like clapping for achievement, you need to make something of yourself so that there is a clearly defined boundary on this experience, so that it is different from the flow of all other experiences. So there's not just another Tuesday where you have something disappointing happen. You know, make it big, 10x it, get some candles out.
Yeah, and that kind of ties into another point that he makes, where it's like, when we regard something as a selfish act, it's not really selfish, because they're not thinking about, you know, themselves in the future, like, aspect of it. Like, when someone makes a selfish act, it's because they're focused on just their present self and not their future self. And it, like, kind of splits it up into two different personalities. It's like you have to make decisions that are good for you today, next week, next month, and next year, and also good for everybody else around you. And it made me think of just the word selfish a little bit differently, because, like, no, it could be something that's good for everybody right now, but the person that you're screwing over is your future self or the people around you in the future. It's like, selfish really talks about the timing more than it does about how oriented you are towards the group or yourself.
Yeah. I think that's that whole probability thing, and just that unwillingness to face the actual outcomes. It's like, you go to do something that you know is bad, and you think, oh, well, it's just a teaspoon of sugar. But it's like, okay, but if you do a teaspoon of sugar right now and every day for the next 1,000 days, how many teaspoons of sugar is it? Would you do all of that right now? No? Okay, why are you doing it over the next 1,000 days?
Well, so far I've been really impressed with this book. It reminds me quite a bit of his Maps of Meaning lectures that he put on YouTube a couple of years ago. I feel I can hear him lecturing in those videos the same way he writes in this book, and that is something that's comforting.
I've definitely enjoyed reading the book, and I am looking forward to the next two rules.
Yeah, and there's a lot in this book where it's like, I've listened to so many of his lectures where I just like, I take stuff from that old lecture and then I insert it right into like the chapter about fog. Like he briefly talks about the knights at the round table, but like when they're all leaving to go find the Holy Grail, they all go to the deepest, darkest part of the forest and they start there. So, like, you gotta start with the fog and focus on the fog and clear that away before you can find the one final prize that you're looking for. Before you can accomplish your aim, you have to go into the fog head first. There's no other way forward. There's gonna be fog every which way.
With that being said, I think I am gonna have to wrap it up. It's getting pretty late.
Yeah. Until next time, well, we're on YouTube, anchor.fm, and wherever you get your podcast. We got our own website at bookwave.club. And may the force be with you.
May the force be with you.
May the force be with you.
Pick up the extra weight.